I'm Pamela Paul, and this is Inside the New York Times Book Review. We are talking this week about our big summer reading issue. Coming in to talk to us today from the Times newsroom, Peter Latman, talking about his review of The Outsider, Jimmy Connors' new memoir.
Connors in this book is really unapologetic. He almost brags about incidents where he comes off like a jerk.
Also, Alexander Jacobs, an editor at the Style section, talking about a new memoir by Patricia Volk.
Patricia Volk's mother, Audrey, was a very powerful figure in her life. She also, as mothers can be, was somewhat problematic.
And we have Anthony Gottlieb in to talk about a new book, No Joke, Making Jewish Humor by Ruth R. Vissa.
She's wondering if there might be a bad side, an unfortunate side to Jewish humor, if Jewish humor can be taken too far.
We will talk to Julie Bosman about BEA, the big book expo convention in town, and Greg Coles will be here with Bestseller News. Welcome.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
I'm here with Peter Latman. He is a staff reporter for Dealbook and for The Times, usually writes about business, but here talking about tennis and The Outsider, a memoir by Jimmy Connors. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Pam.
So tell me about this memoir. Jimmy Connors obviously has not really been playing professionally for quite some time. Why did he explain why he wrote a memoir now?
Yeah, well, there's been somewhat of a boomlet, I think, in tennis memoirs that was somewhat spawned by Andre Agassi's memoir written several years ago. It was a huge success, a number one bestseller, incredibly well reviewed. And Jimmy Connors is such a character that I think for years the publishing houses have been begging him to write a memoir. Tennis memoirs apparently sell quite well, and he was such a great personality that someone convinced him to do so.
And he just had to compete. So in your review, you said that The Outsider is in many ways like Connors himself, irreverent and amusing, but not very likable.
Yeah, I mean, one of the surprising things about this book is, I think I said, you know, Connors is kind of a jerk. And that was the general consensus, both of tennis fans and on the tour. Players were not big fans of his. His competitors did not like him. And he never really made any apologies about that. He was a fierce competitor, and he was one of these guys who just didn't care what anyone else thought of him. As long as he kept winning titles, that was okay. However, you know, you'd think in a book, in a memoir, you'd kind of look back and maybe say, oh, I could have been nicer, or try and justify some of his behavior. But Connors in this book is really unapologetic. He almost brags about incidents where he comes off like a jerk. There's this great scene where he plays John McEnroe for the very first time in 1977. Connors has already been on the tour, a top-ranked player. McEnroe's the upstart 17-year-old.
Not a quiet personality either.
No, but at Wimbledon for the first time. So he was just sort of feeling his way. And he comes up to Connors in the locker room to introduce himself. And Connors has this great scene where he says, I ignored him. I looked right past him. I didn't want to give this guy the time of day. And he's like, I was nothing else if not gracious. So there's a lot of that laced throughout the book where he just doesn't really care what other people think.
And there's no following paragraph about, oh, I should have been a nicer guy. No. Is there introspection in the memoir in general? Does he come across as thoughtful? And
yeah, you know, that was, I think, for me, the disappointing thing about the book. And I said, you know, in some ways it wasn't Connor's fault, because Agassi's memoir really set the standard. You know, I described it as it was dark and it was very complex, and he really did dig deep, and it was this sort of raw examination of a professional athlete's life. You know, Connors, he talks about certain things. He had this obsessive compulsive disorder that he wrestled with throughout his life, a sort of a gambling addiction that he struggled with. He was not faithful to his fiance and then his wife, and he talks about that. But he just didn't peel back the onion just enough where you really gain some insight into either human nature or what it's like to be a pro tennis player, that sort of left me a bit empty.
But, you know, Connors was different from a lot of players of his time. He had a very different background, right?
He did. So the importance of Jimmy Connors in sort of the history of tennis is that he came into the sport at a time when it was just coming. It was transforming from the kind of country club, elitist, all whites world of the 1960s into the open era, where the sport became more democratized and accessible to the general public. And he really represented that. Today we have, you know, the Williams sisters and other people who come from all sorts of backgrounds. And Connors came from East St. Louis, sort of a working class neighborhood in Missouri. And his mother was a great tennis player. And he was his mother's star pupil. And he was this brash, hyper-intense kid, much different from, you know, the country club prep school kids who really used to thrive in the sport.
Readers of the Times may know you not necessarily for tennis, but for covering financial crime, insider trading, Wall Street shenanigans for Dealbook and for the business pages of the Times. But you have an interest in and a background in tennis, right?
Yeah. It was a thrill for me to write this review because, yeah, I think the key phrase here is I was a tennis player. I grew up playing a lot of junior tennis out on Long Island and then played through college and still have a love for the sport. So, you know, I've taken an interest in memoirs like this and sort of follow it closely and have been fortunate enough to write a few tennis-related stories that the sports section has been gracious enough to assign me, and then this book review
And these were the
too.
Guys that you watched as a child then, and do you remember, I mean, did you have an impression of Connors at the time, and did the book change that impression at all?
Or? Yeah, so Connors' best year, his best year was 1974, so I was 4 years old, so he was really, but his longevity was astounding. You know, he played into the sort of the late 80s, early 90s. So, of course, he was one of the guys that I would look up to. You know, my guy, candidly, was John McEnroe from Long Island, or at least Queens, and played out on Long Island. And sort of, I really admired him, and he was a rival of Connors. But yeah, the Borg, Connors, McEnroe rivalries were really intense when I was just sort of starting to learn the sport. So they were my, you know, heroes.
Before you go, tell us one of your favorite stories. It sounds like there are a lot of great anecdotes in the book. What was another good Connors story from the memoir?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll mention something that wasn't that didn't make my review because of space limits. But, you know, one nice thing about Connors, he talks about a guy named Vitas Gerulaitis, who was a great player, a U.S. Open finalist, and also grew up in Great Neck on Long Island near McEnroe. And Connors and Gerulaitis had a wonderful relationship. And it was actually the one time in the book where you really felt that Connors had some humanity. Gerulaitis died way too young at around the age of 40 of carbon monoxide poisoning and a tragic death. And he describes Gerulaitis' funeral, where a lot of the players came back to pay their respects. And he and McEnroe, who were just fierce rivals and hated each other, gave one another a hug at the funeral. And it was just really sort of poignant moment that these guys were, you know, gladiators, and they were obviously mourning the loss of a friend. So there are some really nice scenes in the book. And I think what I ultimately say is that, you know, tennis addicts will really eat it up because there's, you know, just name dropping and people you can, you know, remember from way back when. And it's just a neat read in that sense.
Well, on that warm and fuzzy note about a not very warm and fuzzy guy, Peter Latman talking about Jimmy Connors' memoir, The Outsider. Thanks, Peter.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for coming.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is The New Digital Age, Reshaping the Future of People, Nations, and Business by Eric Schmidt and Jared Cohen. That's The New Digital Age, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Hi, I'm Pamela Paul, and I'm here with Julie Bosman, the publishing reporter for the New York Times. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
So this is BEA week. You and I are both in a frenzy. Book Expo is going on. Tell us about that.
So this is the publishing industry's annual trade show 20,000 publishers, booksellers, librarians, and members of the public gather at the Javits Center in Manhattan. And it's a huge exhibit floor filled with booths from different publishers and retailers. And it's basically a way for everyone to get together, publishers promote their books. And it's really about the independent booksellers who are there to see which books are getting the biggest buzz.
So this is the second year now that it's been open to the public, right?
That's right. On the fourth day, this Saturday, the publishing community has opened it up to, I think, 500 members of the general public. And these people are called power readers, and they can come in and see what's happening just like everyone who's in the industry can.
And in the last few years, there's also a lot of bloggers that have descended on the Javits Center. Everybody's grabbing up their galleys. And what are the big books this year?
This year, there isn't really one big book of the convention, but this morning I went to a breakfast, which was the kind of kickoff keynote author breakfast. Chelsea Handler, who has a book coming out later this year, was the host. Wally Lamb was one of the featured speakers. Doris Kearns Goodwin, who has a biography of Teddy Roosevelt and Taft. And Ishmael Bea, who has a new novel coming out from Sarah Crichton Books, I believe, later this year. So those were just a few of them. Walking around the convention floor, you could see a huge billboard-sized poster for Mitch Albom, who has a new novel coming out this year. And Helen Fielding also has another one of the big books. This is the third Bridget Jones novel that's coming out later this year.
So what's the mood at BEA? Last year was pretty glum, right?
Last year was a difficult year. The Department of Justice, just 2 months earlier, had filed a lawsuit against five of the biggest book publishers, accusing them of engaging in a price-fixing conspiracy with Apple. And this year, now that all five of those publishers have settled the lawsuit with the government, there was a bit of a feeling like they had kind of shaken off a lot of the bad feelings of last year. It was much more calm, much more upbeat. I was at a panel with Michael Peach, the chief executive of Hachette, who said that people are no longer as anxious, that the world is being turned upside down. And there were also some numbers to back that up. A recent survey that was announced a couple of weeks ago showed that like book sales were up. The American Booksellers Association, which is the trade group for the independent booksellers, said this week that their numbers were up for the fourth year in a row. They had an increase of 65 members, so 65 new independent booksellers in the country in the last year. So there was definitely a feeling of optimism and a feeling like everyone could kind of exhale.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Julie.
Thank you.
I'm here with Alexandra Jacobs. Alexandra is an editor at the Thursday and Sunday Styles section of The Times, and she is here to talk about her review of the new book by Patricia Volk. The book is Shocked, My Mother, Schiaparelli, and Me. I just pronounced it wrong. Welcome, Alexandra. And we sat here trying to figure out how to pronounce Schiaparelli.
Schiaparelli.
It's Schiaparelli. Hi, Alexandra. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us about this memoir. This is the second memoir by Patricia Volk.
I adored this memoir. I'd also adored her first one, Stuffed, which was an account of growing up in a boisterous restaurant family. And I believe that one focused, if my memory serves, it focused more on her father. And this one is emphatically about her mother, which I whom I didn't remember from the first one. So this one brings her mother into focus.
That's such an odd thought to think that you could read a childhood memoir and learn all about the father in one book and not much about the mother and then the mother in the second one. But who is her mother and why?
Well, her mother definitely deserved her own book. To me, she was an amazing character. I mean, she was a wife, a mother. She didn't have an occupation outside the home. But she seems to have been an extremely powerful figure in the author's life. I was interested that she yoked her story to Schiaparelli's because though Patricia Volk's mother, Audrey, was a very powerful figure in her life, she also, as mothers can be, was somewhat problematic. And Schiaparelli, it seems, offered her a kind of alternate vision of how to live as a woman, and the ways that she linked their two stories up was very interesting.
For those listeners who don't know who Schiaparelli is, we're talking about Elsa Schiaparelli, and she was a fashion designer. Tell us a little bit more about her and how she figures into this book.
I am fascinated with Elsa Schiaparelli. The timing of this book is interesting because Schiaparelli was also featured last year in the Metropolitan Museum's Costume Institute exhibit, in a parallel exhibit with Prada. And Schiaparelli is a designer that has mostly been lost to history in the sense that she's remembered for creating these sort of amazing, fascinating clothes that looked like artworks that were related to the Dada and Surrealist movements, things like the, now I don't know how to pronounce this either, the Trump.
Trump Day?
Yes, thank you, Pamela. Always at the ready. that kind of sweater, which is basically, you know, a sweater that looks like it has a bow on it or buttons or something that actually doesn't, and a dress with lobsters on it, a dress with tears on it that looked like wounds to the flesh. I mean, just sort of amazing, provocative designs, but she hasn't survived in a kind of mega global brand way, the way that Chanel, her eternal rival, did.
And she's also associated with the color pink. Isn't there an Audrey Hepburn film where there's a character who's modeled on...
Oh, are you thinking of Funny Face?
Yes.
And Think Pink?
Yes.
You know, I actually don't think those two pinks are related.
Okay, different shades.
Yeah, but Schiaparelli pink, yeah, she's probably best remembered for this sort of hot shade of magenta Schiaparelli pink. But really, I think if you stopped women on the street, I mean, nobody, Schiaparelli as a brand is kind of teetering. I think there are various attempts to revive it, but women don't go out now and buy Schiaparelli clothes generally.
So there are three women in this book. Patricia Volk's mother, Audrey Elaine Morgan Volk, who comes from this Jewish restaurant family. She's an heiress to this family. The author, Patricia Volk, and this designer. And what exactly is the relationship between the three women?
Well, it's interesting. It all comes down to a perfume bottle, really. Audrey has a... Schiaparelli licensed her name when she had various problems with her clothing business. She licensed her name to accessories, perfumes, that sort of thing. And Patricia has a very vivid memory of this perfume bottle of Schiaparelli shocking on her mother's dresser. The way that she links their two stories is really kind of it's hard to describe. I mean, she does it through imagery. She does it through buttons.
You have to explain that. How does she do it through buttons?
Well, Patricia Volk's first memory of understanding what nostalgia is when she's looking at her mother's jar of her button collection, which, you know, is a relic. I mean, who now has a button collection? Now with clothes, people tend to replace the clothes before they replace the buttons. But buttons for Schiaparelli were a tremendous opportunity for adornment of clothing, and hers were very whimsical and unusual. The way that Patricia talks about Schiaparelli, you can see what an appealing designer Schiaparelli would be to a child, because her buttons were so crazy.
So we're talking about Shocked. This is Patricia Volk's follow-up to Stuffed, both of them family memoirs. In your review, Alexandra, you said, whatever it takes to get readers into Shocked may be worthwhile. It's a time machine laden with long-lost physical objects, a meditation on the plastic possibilities of womankind, and a very special treat. So sounds intriguing. Thanks so much, Alexandra.
My pleasure.
I am here with Anthony Gottlieb, who reviewed for us a book about Jewish humor. No joke, Making Jewish Humor by Ruth Vissa. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the book. Is it a serious book about Jewish humor?
It is quite a serious book, but it is also very amusing, very entertaining, and of course, absolutely full of jokes. And it begins with one, which I think I'd never heard before. It does have quite a serious thesis running through the book. The title is No Joke, which rather suggests what it's going to be. She's wondering if there might be a bad side, an unfortunate side to Jewish humor, if Jewish humor can be taken too far. She doesn't make all that much of this. I wish she had, in a way, because it's not at all clear, at least to me, just what she was getting at there. But there's a sort of little worry coming through it. However, the book as a whole is not dominated by this thought by any means. It's mainly a very interesting history, extremely interesting history.
Well, I'm going to start with the gloom, and then we'll cheer things up from there. I mean, what would be the downside of Jewish humor?
Well, there is this idea, really going back to Freud. I don't know if he invented it, but he certainly popularized it, that Jewish humor is unusually self-deprecating. Now, his book, Jokes in Their Relation to the Unconscious, which came out early in the 20th century, was really the first serious analysis of jokes. And most of and it's absolutely full of jokes, and most of these jokes are actually Jewish jokes. The reason for this is that Freud had for many years, probably before even he had in mind to do a book on jokes, he'd been collecting Jewish jokes that he particularly liked. Now, what that means, of course, is that his jokes and their relation to the unconscious, his analysis of Jewish jokes, is not by any stretch of the imagination scientific. It's not any sort of objective sample. It's one of the jokes that he particularly liked. So if he finds them to be self-deprecating, you can't actually conclude much from that. And I do rather wonder whether they are self-deprecating. He doesn't actually use that term, I think, but that's how he's been interpreted. He said, does any people, he asked, does any other people make as much fun of themselves as Jews?
I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have me as a member, right? Or something that one of the Marx brothers said much better than me. She doesn't come down one way or the other then on this question exactly, or what?
She seems to have a nagging worry, and that nagging worry, I think the last chapter, the conclusion, is called Can I Stop Joking Now? Or something like that. So that rather suggests, you know, she's quite impressed by this idea. That there's a downside, a dark side to Jewish humor.
One of the things you mentioned was that people sometimes, you talk about the Mrs. Morgan Besser effect.
Yes. What
is that?
Well, this effect, which I coined and discovered.
so that's your coinage and not, okay.
No. So there was a Jewish philosopher called Sidney Morgan Besser, who was famous for his witticisms. And his mother allegedly once said, when asked how she was, "Not so good, thank God." Now, that sounds like a Jewish joke, making fun of one's own pessimism, but it might well not have been. If you come from a religious background of that generation, you quite possibly say thank God after more or less everything. So it's, as it were, an accidental joke. And I use this as an example of how we are now almost conditioned, because of the huge pervasiveness of Jewish humor, to hear some things as Jewish humor when they weren't actually intended as jokes. And that's a rather interesting phenomenon. In fact, I would like to tell a story about my grandmother.
Oh, please do.
A remark that she made once, which illustrates, I think, the Morgan Besser effect, possibly even better than Mrs. Morgan Besser.
The Gottlieb effect.
she was the other side of the family, actually. The Thiesenhausen effect, we'd have to call it. She was a German Jewish refugee, lived in North London near the Finchley Road, as many, many others did. There was a restaurant there called the Cosmos that was run by and for Jews, and she used to go there a lot. And I hadn't seen her for a few months. I'd been away in the States, and I asked her if she still went to this restaurant. And she said, "Ah, no, they're anti-Semitic." "What do you mean? They're Jewish? Everyone there is Jewish." She said, "Yes, but the food's awful." I think this is an instance of the Morgan Besser, actually. She was not intending to make a joke.
Right.
It does usually make people laugh.
And such small portions, right?
Yes, well, it's rather like that.
I mean, what is Jewish humor? That's part of what the author is trying to address here, to, you know, how is it different from other forms, and
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. Well, she doesn't actually defend the idea that Jewish humor is different from other humor. She's much too good a historian for that, because plainly it's been through all sorts of different phases. It has an enormous range. She talks about its huge range. Just think about the famous American Jewish comedians of the 20th century, and they range from Lenny Bruce to Danny Kaye and everything in between. Now, what do all these people have in common, apart from humor? You know, it's very hard to narrow it down. I think about Jewish humor a lot because I enjoy it, and it's a fascinating subject, but I certainly don't have any general theory. And I think it's to her, Professor Visser's credit, that she doesn't have a general theory either. She traces its different forms. One of the particularly interesting bits is where she talks about humor in Israel, because it used to be claimed, up until a few decades ago, by some people that the Jews in Israel were not very funny and didn't make jokes. And the idea was, well, they were on top now. You only made jokes when you were the underdog. Once you got the guns, you don't need the jokes anymore. Professor Visser spends quite a lot of time on Israeli humor, and it certainly exists. So that is wrong.
And what is Israeli humor, if it's different from Jewish American humor or the sort of, you know, traditional European?
I would say that there isn't a huge difference. It's in many respects like American Jewish humor. Of course, the subjects will be slightly different because it's in a different environment.
So if we can't necessarily define it, are there characteristics that, or different strains within Jewish humor that we can talk about as being characteristic?
One thing I think is characteristic of some Jewish humor, by no means all, is, well, one thing is obviously wordplay, which you find in some forms of humor more than others. Ambiguity and wordplay of all sorts is particularly strong in Jewish humor, and it's usually said that if there is an explanation of this, it's from the very literary, book-based, argumentative, scholarly culture of Judaism. Another theme, I think, is a sort of almost joyful embrace of pessimism, which is something I think one can trace back to certain parts of the Bible, especially Ecclesiastes.
Is there a difference between Yiddish humor and Jewish humor? Does she talk about that?
She does quite a lot. Well, the difference is mainly that the Yiddish humor is in Yiddish.
In Yiddish, but I imagine there's a lot of wordplay in there.
Yes. Of course, they're merging because a lot of Yiddish terms, this is the case far more in New York than in London, where I come from, Yiddish has entered American English, all sorts of terms people probably don't know even that they were Yiddish. The humor in the ghettos before was created in conditions which are in every sense much less happy than the humor that's created now. And of course, to some extent, one would expect the humor to reflect that. There is one danger, actually, though, in looking at jokes from different periods and drawing conclusions about how different Jewish humor might have been in that period. And that is that the jokes that end up collected in anthologies and studied are not necessarily a good representation of what Jews amongst themselves are being humorous about. A joke will get into a book of Jewish jokes because it's about Jews, not necessarily that it was invented by Jews or even that this is the sort of joke they tell all the time.
But lest we have a totally grim, humorless conversation about a book about joking, you did mention that there are a lot of jokes in the book.
There certainly are.
Any favorites you'd like to share?
There's one joke at the beginning of this that she tells, and she tells it at the beginning because she tells the story of a non-Jewish person overhearing it and being uncomfortable with it. I think this was someone who was dating a Jewish man and was wondering, you know, is this anti-Semitic to tell this sort of joke? And she starts with this discovery. But the joke goes, if I remember it rightly, that an Englishman, a Frenchman, a German, and a Jew. I'm not sure where one puts them together like that because Jewish is, of course, not a nationality. But they're all going on a hike and they run out of food and water. And the Frenchman says, "Oh, I'm so thirsty, I must have wine." And the Englishman says, "Oh, I'm so thirsty, I must have tea." And the German says, "Oh, I'm so thirsty, I must have beer." And the Jew says, "Oh, I'm so thirsty, I must have diabetes."
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you. That was Anthony Gottlieb talking about the new book, No Joke, Making Jewish Humor by Ruth R. Visser from our summer reading issue. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
Greg Coles is here to talk about bestseller news. Welcome, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So what's going on this week?
Well, on the combined list again, it continues the trend of books that are either older books or books that are not new on the hardcover list are becoming new on the combined list, which just shows the continued influence of ebooks and also paperbacks. There are only two new titles on the hardcover list that are also on the combined list this week. On the fiction side, that new title is at number two. It is Khaled Hosseini's new novel, And the Mountains Echoed, another family melodrama set in Afghanistan. He, of course, is the author of The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Sons. Since 2003, when we were actively at war in Afghanistan, he has been the guy bringing us news in fiction of that country. The other new books on the combined fiction list this week are at number nine, a romance called Binding Agreement, a little bit of a pun in that title there. This picks up where Shades of Grey left off. It's the third in a series by Kira Davis, and it's about a one-night stand that becomes a real kind of power play. Then at number 14, Max Brooks's 2006 novel World War Z, which is a zombie novel, makes its debut on the combined list. That book is selling well right now. The movie version of the book is coming out next month.
It's a Brad Pitt vehicle.
Yes.
Like a gazillion-dollar movie, right?
And actually, the book has had a lot of success in print. It's coming up on a year on the trade paperback list. It tops that list this week. It's at the top of the trade paperback list after 48 weeks. And so it now is finally cracking into the combined list.
So just to be clear to our listeners, when we say combined list, we're talking about platform agnostic. The book, no matter whether it's sold in hardcover, paperback, or ebook, this is sort of the best of everything.
That's exactly right. These are the books that are selling. It doesn't matter how people are reading them, in what format, these are the books that are selling. And then finally, a romance called Tangled by Emma Chase is new on the combined fiction list at number 15. The twist in that book is that it's a romance told from the male perspective.
So romance, erotica, war, and Afghanistan. An unusual combination.
Zombies.
Right.
And war.
Zombies.
Yes. And then on the nonfiction side of the combined list, there are only two new titles. One of them is also new on the hardcover nonfiction list this week. It holds the number one position on both lists, the combined nonfiction and the hardcover nonfiction list. That book is Phil Jackson's autobiography, 11 Rings, written with Hugh Delahanty. Jackson, you probably know, is the longtime basketball coach who 11 rings is a reference to the number of championships that he had as the head coach, both of the Chicago Bulls with Michael Jordan and the Los Angeles Lakers with Shaquille O'Neal. So he coached some superstars to, I believe, 11 championships is more championships than any other professional coach in any other professional sport. And then the second book that's new on the combined nonfiction list this week is called My Greek Drama. It's by a woman named Gianna, it's G-I-A-N-N-A, Angelopoulos. She is Greek. She's a Greek politician and ambassador.
In case you didn't guess.
And she was instrumental in bringing the 2004 Olympics to Greece and to saving them from kind of all kinds of political debacles. She's been touring the U.S. to promote this book. She's done Morning Joe on MSNBC. She's appeared on Fox, and she's been doing a lot of events. Still, it's kind of a mystery to me why this book is selling so well. It's an insider story of Greek politics. I do note that it's been on the hardcover nonfiction list for a couple of weeks now, where it has a dagger, which means that it's not necessarily reflecting individual sales. The dagger is to suggest that there are some bookstores are reporting bulk sales. So it may be that at these events she's appearing out, she's just passing out copies of her book, and she's the one paying for
the
them
all. The suspicious dagger.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There may be some effort to game the system there.
It looks like there are two books here on the nonfiction by women that have been there for quite some time, too, right? Bossy Pants, by Tina Fey's memoir, still.
Yeah, you know, that has a lot of kind of summer reading appeal to it, but it has sold well since it came out. That's right.
And Wild by Cheryl Strayed.
Yeah, that book is not going anywhere. It's still selling well in print, too. It recently came out in paperback and is still on the paperback nonfiction list in its 9th week. And I believe even in hardcover, it's still lingering on or near the extended list. So that's a book that has just continued to build momentum.
A true combined bestseller.
Yeah.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you so much for joining us. There's more online at www.nytimes.com/books. And for the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.